We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
From WILL Illinois Public Media, this is Focus on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good morning, I'm Celeste Quinn. His election bid for Congress in 2000 was a disaster, but 8 years later, he was elected president. We'll talk this morning about Barack Obama. Our guest this morning is political journalist Ted McClelland. He is the author of Young Mr. Obama, Chicago, and the Making of a Black President. In the book, McClelland argues that if Barack Obama had not launched his political career in Chicago, he would not have become president. McClelland also says, quoting here, if Harold Washington had never been mayor of Chicago, Barack Obama would not have become president of the United States. In fact, it was Harold Washington's election as mayor of the city that drew Obama to Chicago to work as a community organizer. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with a phone call. I look forward to your questions and comments. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. The toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. Edward McClelland is a former staff writer for the Chicago Reader. He's also contributed to many other publications, including the New York Times and the Boston Globe. Young Mr. Obama is Ted McClelland's third book. It is published by Bloomsbury. Again, the phone number is 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Ted McClelland, how are you?
Oh, great. It's great to be on WILL. I want to say hi to all my friends in Decatur. I lived there before I moved to Chicago.
That's so right.
I hope they're listening over there.
Yeah. Well, it's good to talk with you again. We talked with you following the election.
Right.
Yeah. So, well, what led Barack Obama to leave New York to become a community organizer in Chicago? Was it Harold Washington?
Well, he wanted to live in a city where African Americans were controlling their own destiny. I think number one, you know, he'd had a corporate job and he kind of felt like a corporate sellout, and so he quit that and was trying to get into community organizing. And I really think he was trying to build a black identity at that time in his life when he was 23 years old. And Chicago has the largest concentration of African Americans in the United States. That's why it was nicknamed Black Metropolis. And at the time, you know, Harold Washington was mayor, so Chicago was kind of seen as the city at the center of black political empowerment in the United States.
Barack Obama was long fascinated by the history of American civil rights. When and how did that interest begin?
Well, he, one anecdote that I heard in the book was that Jerry Kelman, the guy who hired him, was to be a community organizer on the South Side. He was a little worried that Obama was spending too much time in his apartment just reading these huge books. And one of the books he read was Parting the Waters, which is Taylor Branch's 1,000-page history of the civil rights movement. And he came up to Kelman and said, this book is my story. And I think he was also fascinated with some of the people that he met who had been around during the civil rights movement, like Reverend Alvin Love, who was a Southside preacher who had been born in Mississippi and had lived on the West Side during the 1968 riots. And, you know, Obama himself, I mean, he was in Hawaii during that period. So I think, you know, he felt he'd missed out on all that.
Yeah. But it was very interesting for me as a reader later in your book to read how he put down Bobby Rush in that campaign for Congress, saying the marching days were long over.
Right. Right. And that, you know, he, number one, he was running in the wrong race at that time. I mean, Obama wasn't meant to be the representative of one single race. I mean, he was meant to be a guy who could reconcile the different races, and I don't think he understood that at the time. And number two, I mean, that was certainly the wrong message for that electorate, because, I mean, the people who were voting in the Democratic primary were older people. I mean, they had grown up in the era of Jim Crow and color lines and restrictive covenants on the South Side of Chicago. So, I mean, they had seen how the marching days had directly, you know, affected and improved their own lives. And so I think a lot of people found that insulting. Certainly Bobby Rush did.
Yeah. And also here, I think it's important to note that with all he'd accomplished, maybe he'd been blinded by his ambition and what he had been able to accomplish. He was, you know, golden for a long time.
Right. Well, I think he, you know, he was still at the point in his life when he thought that all he had to do was say, I was the first black president of the Harvard Law Review, and people were going to give him whatever he wanted, and every door was going to open up to him. I mean, I remember when I interviewed him during that campaign, one of the things he said to me was, you know, well, being the president of the Harvard Law Review is a pretty big deal. And, you know, I could be doing other things. You know, I could be making a lot of money on Wall Street. But, you know, look, here I am on the south side of Chicago, which proves how committed I am to this neighborhood, to this district, which was kind of an arrogant thing to say, I thought.
Yeah. What did he learn from that campaign, do you think?
Well, I think he learned that, you know, he was going to have to get a legislative record, and he wasn't just going to be able to run on his resume. When he went back to Springfield after losing that race, a lot of his colleagues thought he was a lot more serious, and he was a lot more collegial. When he first went to Springfield, I think he kind of turned up his nose at the hard, dirty work of legislative deal making. You know, I think he thought maybe that was below his intellectual training. And Rich Miller, who's a well-known, he writes a newsletter in Springfield called Capital Facts. One of the things he said to me in 2000 was, Barack is a very intelligent man, but he hasn't had a lot of success here because he kind of places himself above everybody. He likes people to know he went to Harvard. Mm. So, you know, I think he learned that he had to get his nose out of the air a little bit.
Yeah. Here maybe it would be useful to talk about his association with Tony Rezko, because here's Barack Obama, who sees himself above all the fray,
right,
yet he knows Tony Rezko is under a cloud.
Right. Well, you know, as someone said to me, you know, I think Obama thought that he was pure enough or his intentions were good enough so that he could associate with Tony Rezko and somehow, you know, not be tainted himself. Which I think is a common delusion of a lot of politicians, where, you know, if you have good intentions, that the means are not as important as the end. But Rezko was certainly a guy who spotted Obama as a comer at a very early period. I think even when he was still in law school, he was already cultivating him. He took him out to lunch, and on the very day Obama announced his first campaign for office, Rezko. This was the state senate in 1995. Rezko wrote him a check. But yeah, the land deal where he allowed Rezko to, you know, buy the property next door and then sell him some of it so he could get the house he wanted. I mean, by then he should have known better than to be dealing with Tony Rezko.
Yeah. Well, let's go back in time to the mid-1980s.
Okay.
How did Barack Obama land that organizing job for the, is it Developing Communities Project?
Right, right. Well, that had been, it was a group, and it had been founded to deal with a lot of the problems that resulted from the closing of the steel mills on the southeast side of Chicago. And they, at its beginnings, almost the members were black, the churches that they worked through were black, but they had a white organizer. So the president of the organization and the preachers on the south side who were involved in this were telling Jerry Kelman, look, you have to find a black organizer. And he looked all over Chicago, and he couldn't find the right person, and he was kind of thinking the problem was that anyone who's qualified to do this job is too smart to do this job. So he put an ad in a magazine called Community Jobs, and Obama picked it up in the reading room of the New York Public Library and wrote a letter in to Kelman, and the next time Kelman was in New York, he interviewed Obama in a coffee shop on Lexington Avenue, and I think he was worried at first that Obama might be, you know, Japanese. You know, he'd never seen a name like that before, But you know, as soon as he as soon as he talked to Obama and saw he was African American, he realized he was the right guy for the job. So he hired him at $10,000 a year and gave him $2,000 to buy a car, and Obama was on his way to Chicago.
Yeah. We're going to come back to Jerry Kelman and Developing Communities Project in a moment, but we've got a listener who's joined us now, and rather than launching into another question, I'm going to invite our caller into the conversation.
Okay.
Line one, Champaign County, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking the call early. I wanted to talk about Hollywood Ricky Herndon and confirm a story that he has in his book. But you're talking about Resco. And there's a lot of talk about upstate corruption, Chicago corruption, but
right.
I think it's interesting to point out, and maybe Celeste, you can confirm this, but my memory is that Resco's, one of his trials was associated with William Cellini, who at the time was county chair in Sangamon County of the Republican Party. So he was sort of a equal opportunity bipartisan grifter, Resco was, and it's not all upstate. I believe they were shaking down a Hollywood producer for money to get money for this subsidy of filmmaking or something, some kind of kickback scheme. That was the allegation, and I don't know where it is at the trial. So I wanted to mention that because down here, if one talks about Chicago and politics, or the corruption is immediately the first thing. Well, maybe that's true, but it isn't just in Chicago.
No, don't forget about Paul Powell.
Where was he? He's from way central Illinois.
He's from way far southern Illinois. I think he's from Vine.
Yeah, I see, yeah. But the thing I wanted to talk about was how they call him Hollywood Ricky Herndon, and I guess
right. That's
sort of a disparaging thing.
Well, he likes the nickname. He embraced that.
He was in the press recently when he was campaigning with Quinn, and Quinn had to embarrass about the way he attacked Brady. But
right. Well, all Herndon did then there was translate what Quinn had been saying about Brady all year
into
the language of his own constituents. So he didn't say anything about Brady that Quinn hadn't been saying. He just used different words.
Used the vernacular.
Exactly.
Right. Herndon describes an incident in the Senate, state Senate, was while Obama had launched his Senate campaign. If you want to talk about Illinois politics, talk about the Republican Party getting Alan Keyes to run against Obama. I think they could have found somebody with another name and could have gotten maybe stopped Obama there. But anyway, that's an aside too. But
I don't think anybody was going to beat Obama that year, especially after that speech. And I don't think anybody wanted to run against him. I think that's why they
right.
went with Alan Keyes.
Well, anyway, the Herndon incident is, as recounted, was Herndon was shocked that Obama voted against some social spending.
Right.
He voted for a cut in social spending.
He voted against a DCFS office in Herndon's West Side district.
Ah, well, so it was.
He voted close.
Within the next hour, as Herndon recounts it, Obama voted in favor of some money that was actually maybe the DCF office in Hyde Park.
Yeah, he voted in favor of keeping it open in Hyde Park.
And so Obama, when Herndon confronted Obama, he said, well, why did you vote against this? He said, well, we have to be fiscally responsible.
Right, yeah.
Just kind of fluffed him off. And right. then within an hour, the other vote came up, and Obama got up and talked about compassion.
Right.
And why we had to. So you know the story. It's not. I'm just.
Yeah, I'm just looking it up in the book. There was a budget cut for a grant to the Chicago for summer youth jobs, and Obama rose to speak against cutting that.
And that's when they had the duel.
Right, yeah. That was too much sanctimony for Herndon to bear. So Herndon, he called out Obama on the Senate floor. He said, I just want to say to the last speaker, you've got a lot of nerve to talk about being responsible that you voted for closing the DCFS office on the West Side. And then after that, Obama came over to him, and he said, you embarrassed me on the Senate floor. If you ever do it again, I'll kick your ass. And Herndon said, really? And Obama said, you heard me. And if you come back here by the telephones where the press can't see, I'll kick your ass right now. So they went back by the telephones, and they kind of got into a little scuffle, which had to be broken up by Senator Donnie Trotter.
And there was another confrontation that you relate in the book. This is one where the president of the Senate, Emil Jones, had to break it up.
Well, that was pretty much part of the same
same story.
Yeah. It was Hendon wouldn't talk about the fight on TV, but he denied making up with Obama. When Obama heard that, he started walking back to Hendon's desk. But before he could get there, Hendon shouted for Emil Jones. He shouted, "Get this guy out of my face!" And Jones dragged Obama off the floor.
Yeah. At the end of this chapter, I'll kick your ass, you write, Obama had shown the Westsider he was a fighter, not just
right.
a passionless lawyer professor who wouldn't stand up for himself. Some senators who could never imagine Obama losing his cool wondered if the entire fight had been calculated to make just that point.
Right, because Hendon and Donnie Trotter really were kind of tormented Obama, especially over his racial identity for years. You know, they'd say, "Have you figured out if you're black or white?" They'd, they bought copies of Dreams from My Father and, you know, read them in Trotter's office, and they were smoking cigars. They would call him Senator Yo Mama behind his back. Trotter and Obama actually both ran in that race against Bobby Rush. And Trotter said to me, when I was reporting on it for the Reader, he said, "Barack is viewed in our community as the white man in blackface." So, I mean, he had some problems with his black colleagues. I mean, they resented him, I think, partly because he wasn't from a traditional black background. And I think they also saw that he had kind of attracted the eye of Emil Jones. And so he was a competitor as they were all trying to climb the leadership ladder.
Yeah. What was their relationship like following the 2000 primary when Obama lost to Bobby Rush for Congress? Did the relationship between Donnie Trotter and Ricky Hendon and Barack Obama, did it change at all?
I don't think it really started to change until he ran for the Senate. And even then, you know, Emil Jones really had to work some members of the Black Caucus to get behind Obama. I mean, Hendon, you know, he met with Hendon several times to try to get him to support Obama, and Hendon didn't really come over to Obama until Obama came and campaigned in a church on the West Side. And as Hendon relates it, Michelle leaned over to him and said, "You know, I've got him." And, you know, to Hendon, you know, Michelle, she's a real Chicagoan. She's a black woman from the South Side, and to hear her say, "I've got him," that was enough for Hendon to say, "Okay, this guy, we can support this guy. You know, this guy's on our side. He's one of us." And of course, now, you know, Hendon posts up all these pictures of him smiling with Obama, and you know, and he wouldn't talk about the fight during the campaign. But as soon as it was over, as soon as Obama won, he wouldn't stop bragging about it. You know, he put it in his book, and he talked about it in appearances for his book. So, you know, he was asked about it several times during the campaign and wouldn't say a thing.
Yeah. The caller who we talked with a moment ago also mentioned the campaign for the U.S. Senate and how things just fell right into Obama's lap, I would say, with all the missteps from the Republican Party, and the nominee had stepped down, and it was just quite the campaign to see, you know, Barack Obama capture the U.S. Senate seat
right
in the state of Illinois.
Well, this may be the only place he could have captured the U.S. Yeah. Senate seat. I mean, Illinois is, since Reconstruction, Illinois has had three of the four black senators. And I think Chicago and Illinois have a longer and deeper history of black political empowerment than any other place in the country. We've had more black statewide officials than any other state. We've had a black alderman since 1915. So I think this is the other side. This is the positive side of the machine politics that are so often reviled in Chicago. I mean, machine politics is about ethnic coalitions. So as soon as African Americans began migrating up here during World War I to work in the munitions industry, they were recruited by the ruling politicians of the day. You know, and this being the land of Lincoln, they could vote here, and their votes were important.
Yeah.
So there's a long history of black politics that boosted Obama to where he is now.
It's also interesting to think about something that you write about in Young Mr. Obama. As you know, we know Chicago as, you know, the most segregated city in the country in the 20th century.
And well, that contributed to it, too.
Yeah.
Because blacks were so concentrated, they couldn't be gerrymandered out of a ward or a congressional seat. And you know, they were able to develop their own politicians and their own professional class. And they were able to develop a strong middle class here.
And that's how Harold Washington made his way.
Exactly. He was a real linchpin figure. And Carroll Moseley Braun honestly helped Obama's career too, because he was just getting into politics, working on a campaign called Project Vote, and their goal was to sign up 150,000 African Americans. They wanted to kind of duplicate the campaign, the voter registration drive that led to Harold Washington's election, and I think he was hired for this maybe in January, and then in March, Carroll Moseley Braun won the primary, and that made Obama's job immensely easier because people were running up to his registrar saying, I want to register to vote so I can vote for Carroll. So she made him look like a big success in that, and that gave him a boost in politics.
Mm-hmm. Journalist Ted McClelland is our guest here this morning on Focus in this hour of the program. He's the author most recently of Young Mr. Obama, Chicago, and the Making of a Black President. In this book, Ted McClelland argues that if Barack Obama had not launched his political career in Chicago, he would not have become president. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this morning with questions, comments. Join us with a phone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, let's go back to the mid-1980s, the Developing
Okay.
Communities Project, Jerry Kelman. And Kelman was a student of Saul Alinsky.
Right.
So let's talk a little bit about that, because that's something that people have pummeled Obama with.
Right.
On the right.
Well, I mean, Alinsky, I mean, Chicago is the birthplace of community organizing. I mean, not just with Saul Alinsky, but even going back further with Jane Addams. And I think Alinsky really modeled his... his organization on the Chicago machine. I mean, in a lot of ways, he wanted it to be a counterweight to the Chicago machine, because in the 40s and the 50s, Chicago was really becoming a one-party city. I mean, there was no opposition to Mayor Daley, and he wanted to teach people that there was a way to express yourself politically outside of your local ward organization. And he worked through the churches a lot too, because he recognized, even though he was Jewish himself, he recognized that the churches were power bases in a lot of these neighborhoods, and that the priests were people who could get people organized. I mean, he started organizing in back of the yards, and then he later organized in Woodlawn, and interestingly, kind of resisted some of the University of Chicago's urban renewal projects there. And of course he was long dead by the time Obama arrived, but Obama was trained by people who had been trained by Alinsky, including Greg Galuzzo, who's with the Gamaliel Foundation, which trains organizers in Chicago.
What did Obama think of Alinsky's model?
Well, I think that there were, obviously he read Rules for Radicals, and there were a couple instances where, he very explicitly used Alinsky-style tactics in his organizing. For example, when he was trying to get the Chicago Housing Authority to remove asbestos from several housing projects, including Altgeld Gardens, which is one of the projects where Obama was working, he organized. Well, the first thing that happened was that the story got into the Chicago Reporter, and then from there it got into the Chicago Tribune, and it got onto Channel 2. Walter Jacobson put it on the air. And then Obama organized a bus trip down to CHA headquarters to sit out in the in the hallway and demand a meeting with the head of the CHA. So you know, he knew that you had to, you know, they didn't have a lot of money, they didn't have a lot of political power, but they could use publicity and they could use moral authority to force the CHA to give them what they wanted. I mean, that was the only leverage he had.
Hmm. What should we know about the areas of Chicago that Obama worked in particular Altgeld Gardens?
Well, Altgeld Gardens is on the very far south side of Chicago. I mean, it's right on the Calumet River. And it is probably, gosh, one of the poorest, most isolated sections of the entire city. It's 5 miles from the nearest L stop. Half the residents don't have cars, so they can't get to a job, even if they could get a job. The cops call it Alligator Gardens because of the drug dealing that goes on down there. And, I mean, it was originally built for blacks who came up to work in the steel mills during World War II. But, yeah, Altgeld Gardens is it's just like a reservation for poor blacks down there. And so one of Obama's tasks was figuring out how he could find these people jobs. And one of the things he accomplished as a community organizer was to get the city to put an employment training center in Roseland, which is a short bus ride from Altgeld Gardens, so these people could have some place to go where they could find work.
Yeah, that was really striking. There wasn't a jobs office.
Well, there was
for
the only
miles.
The only jobs office was in South Chicago, and you had to take 3 buses to get there, and also it was in Edward Doliak's ward, so a lot of blacks didn't want to go over there.
Hmm. It seems to me that Barack Obama, as a young organizer, was pretty savvy, but yet he really didn't know a lot about politics, and he didn't know the black church.
No, he didn't really. I mean, he hadn't grown up in the black church. I mean, he hadn't had any kind of religious upbringing at all. But as soon as he got there, Kelman told him, you know, I want you to go around, I want you to talk to the preachers, and I want you to find out what they want and what their problems are. And some of the preachers were hostile to him, and they would ask him, you know, what's your home church? And, you know, he didn't have a home church, and they didn't like that answer too much. And, you know, he was 23 years old, and so I guess they saw him as a competitor. And he finally found an ally in Reverend Alvin Love, who was the pastor of a church in Roseland, which it had kind of just moved from another part of the South Side into a Lutheran church, which had been abandoned by whites fleeing from the suburbs. And Love was a pretty young guy. And so he and Obama sort of naturally formed an alliance. But, I mean, the Developing Communities Project, it was a church-based, it was a religiously-based organization, and they would begin and end every meeting with a prayer. And I think, you know, Obama really, really learned about the role. I mean, he knew it from reading, but I don't think he'd seen it firsthand about the role of the black church in a secular way, in a worldly way, of improving the lives and the fortunes of the black community.
This is Focus. Our guest this morning, journalist Ted McClelland, author most recently of Young Mr. Obama, Chicago and the Making of a Black President. Let's take another call. This is a listener in Champaign. Line one, hi.
Hi. First, I'd like to say that I did not vote for Barack Obama or the senator for Arizona. His name escapes me. I wrote in Harry Truman's name as a protest to the inadequacy of both candidates. And I'd like to ask the author a question.
Okay.
It's my feeling that Obama came much too soon to the presidency with a lot of missing experience And as a result of that missing experience, has made a lot of mistakes during his first 2 years. I think also that he is a very doctrinaire person who establishes a perspective and is not a great compromiser. And I wondered if you would be willing to comment on my points.
Yeah, well, let me just ask you, what do you see the mistakes he's made that have resulted from his lack of experience?
Well, first is the healthcare initiative.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was advised by some of his staff to start with a small portion of the revision, as opposed to the massive one that he embarked on. Second, and he's admitted to this, he wasn't as open to conversations with Republicans as he should have been.
Mm-hmm.
And I compare what Bill Clinton did after he was brought up sharply in terms of working with the Republican Congress. I think in terms of working with the military, it's evident to me that he didn't have enough experience to come up with a decision, and kept postponing until he finally was forced to make one.
Mm-hmm.
One final comment is that he is far too evident in the media, to the point, from my perspective, of being somewhat obnoxiously present.
Okay. Well, you know, I think that there is a point to be made that he didn't. I mean, he didn't have any executive experience before he came into the White House. And actually, during the Democratic primary in 2008, I didn't vote for anybody because I wasn't convinced that Obama was ready to be president. So, I don't think anybody comes into the White House ready to be president. I mean, I think every president has a tough time their first couple of years. It takes that long to learn the job, and I think one thing that Obama and Bill Clinton had in common was that, coming from where they came from, they weren't prepared for the types of Republican opposition they were going to face. I mean, Obama certainly hadn't seen Republicans in Illinois as conservative as the Republicans he faced in Congress. But I would disagree that he's completely doctrinaire and that he went too far on the health care bill. One thing I learned from researching this book is that expanding access to health care has been the number one cause of Obama's career. And in every session of the Illinois legislature, he would introduce a constitutional amendment for universal health care in Illinois. And right before he was elected to the Senate, he passed a bill to convene a task force for finding ways to bring health care to everyone in Illinois. So I think if he could have done anything he wanted, he would have passed a single-payer bill, and he would have passed a public option. But I think he realized that he was not going to get the votes for that, and so he conceded to a lesser package. And but I'm glad he went as far as he did, because I think that no matter what he had done in his first 2 years, the Democrats would have lost the House of Representatives. I just think that people don't like to see one party controlling all of Washington, and they want to balance things out. So, I mean, I'm glad he used his majority to accomplish something he really wanted to accomplish while he still had a majority.
And let's have the listener follow up if he'd like.
Well, you're certainly entitled to your opinion. I question how astute a politician he is, given the limited amount of experience that he's had, both in governing and in life experience, and I feel that Clinton's years in state government,
mm-hmm,
prepared him in part for his role as president. Certainly, anyone, no matter how brilliant and how experienced, is going to face a steep learning curve when they become president of the United States. In some situation, that steep learning curve is leveraged by the quality of advice
mm-hmm.
The president gets from individuals who are highly qualified. And then again, that leads me to wonder about the quality of the staff that he brought into the White House.
Right. I mean, he brought in a lot of people from outside Washington. He brought in a lot of people, you know, from Chicago. And I think one reason he wanted Rahm Emanuel so badly was Rahm Emanuel was both from Chicago, you know, and from Washington, and he could help bridge those two worlds. I mean, one thing everybody says about Obama is he's the fastest learner they've ever seen. And so I think that this, you know, losing to Bobby Rush humbled him in a way he needed to be humbled, and I hope that these midterm elections humble him also in a way he needs to be humbled and help him figure out what kind of president he is or what kind of president he needs to be. I mean, you know, Obama is just, he's not naturally a humble guy, so he needs corrections like this. And I didn't think it was a bad thing for the Republicans to win the House of Representatives, because I think he needs a foil as he runs for re-election, and he needs the Republicans to share responsibility for governing in Washington. And, you know, I think, you know, there's certainly a point to be made that, you know, he didn't have executive experience when he came in, or he didn't have enough executive experience. But at least for the next 2 years, he's the only president we've got. So hopefully, you know, he is going to climb that learning curve.
And I want to thank the listener for his call. I'm going to take another call now in Piatone, line 4. Hi.
Hey, good morning. I kind of agree with you and I kind of disagree with you. Here are two points. If everybody knew exactly what this guy was made of,
mm-hmm.
As far as experience and knowledge and what his voting record, just how his voting record in the state of Illinois was,
mm-hmm.
and just in general, before he became president, I don't think we'd be talking about Barack Obama today. We might be talking about Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, I did not vote for him, actually, because I didn't think he had the experience.
Okay.
You know, a lot of people voted for, like, John McCain on the Republican side because,
right.
you know, he had experience, but some people didn't vote for him just for the plain and simple fact that Sarah Palin is running.
Right.
The point is, no matter who's in office, all right, and I think he's just a talking figurehead. In my point of view,
mm-hmm.
I think it's the Congress and the Senate of the United States that run this country
mm-hmm.
and not Barack Obama
mm-hmm.
Because of the, you know, what they do on a daily basis. And unfortunately, I think they've lost touch completely with the American situation. I was watching a TV program the other night
mm-hmm.
that was explaining the loss of the dream, the American dream.
Right.
It's gone.
Right.
And there are a lot of people that are very, very upset that he's going around apologizing to the rest of the world about us. And what I would like to see,
mm-hmm.
no matter who is in office, somebody who's going to be strong, stern, stand in front of the podium and speak to other countries as a person, not as somebody apologizing, somebody who's going to go out. And, again, Korea is a good example. Did he come out and say anything? No.
Mm-hmm.
But we tend to go back and forth on the same situation, on the same things with the same countries day in and day out. And until somebody gets there and gets a backbone, you know, it's hard for me to stand behind a president who's wishy-washy on this. And I think the American people understand this.
Well, I think, you know, I think one reason where you say, or maybe he's giving you the impression that he's going around apologizing was, we had a president for the 8 years before him who basically went around the world and said, you know, we don't care what you think. The United States is going to do whatever it wants. Because, you know, we're a special nation. We have a God-ordained duty to spread our values all over the world. And so, you know, whatever we do is a holy cause. And I think that really alienated a lot of countries. And perhaps you think that what Obama is doing is an overreaction to, what Bush did in the last 8 years.
I want to thank the listener for his call. I've got a couple of other calls, so we're going to go next to a listener on line one.
Okay.
In Urbana. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I had one point. The criticism of Obama for not being, in the speaker's words, able to talk to the Republicans, I think is ludicrous. There was no way he could talk to these people. Their only interest was in obstruction and denying a second term. And I think he's going to find that to be the case again now that they are in power, although it's going to be more difficult for them. They're going to bear some responsibility for their
exactly.
obstructionism.
Exactly.
And I think he has to campaign as Truman did with against a do-nothing Congress.
Mm-hmm.
I criticize him for not attacking the Republicans strongly enough at first, that he tried too hard to get along with people no one could get along with. I think you hinted at this, that he had not known Republicans as right-wing as the ones he encountered in Washington.
Right, right. I mean, there was this anecdote when he worked on a death penalty reform bill with Senator Ed Petka, who I think was from Plainfield, and you know his nickname was Electric Ed,
mm-hmm.
because you know he'd won several death penalty convictions as a prosecutor. But I don't think even the most conservative Illinois politician is any match for somebody from maybe Alabama or Texas.
Probably not. Being here in Illinois, having grown up
radically moderate state,
but. Yes, we have some fairly conservative people, but probably very few that can match the people in Alabama and Texas.
Right.
The other point was his, apparently to the one speaker, weakness in apologizing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the apologies were largely over the syphilis experiments in Guatemala,
okay.
which were horrendous and called for an apology. These were things that even the Nazi doctors rarely rose to.
Well, I mean, there are people who think that anything less than saying America can do whatever it wants is weakness and vacillation. And I mean, Obama's made it clear that he wants stronger alliances than Bush formed. I mean, he wants to do things in concert with other countries.
I want to thank the listener for his call. I've got a couple of other people waiting. Let's go next to a listener in Urbana. Line two, hi.
Hi. I just want to remind people who have Clinton nostalgia, which I do. I enjoyed his presidency a great deal. But if you look at where Clinton was at the same point in his presidency, in the spring of his second year as president, his presidency was widely declared by the pundits to be over. It was in mm-hmm. such disarray that he actually got David Gergen, a senior White House advisor for Ronald Reagan, to come in and help right the ship.
Well, I think
Obama has taken some licks. His personal popularity is in line with where Reagan and Clinton were at the same point in their career.
Mm-hmm.
People are far too eager to simply write him off and compare him unfavorably to the successful Clinton and the successful Reagan, and they simply don't remember how rocky things were for these two people who are widely revered as having successful presidency, whether you like their policies or not.
Well,
Obama, there's a long way to go before the reelection, and if he's as bright as we all think he is, get some new advisors around, I think he'll be in good shape.
Well, it's interesting you talk about Reagan, because I think in 1982 the country was even worse shape than it has been the last couple of years.
I mean, I was on the streets demonstrating against everything Reagan did, and in 82 we were absolutely certain
mm-hmm.
that we were going to defeat him.
Oh, the steel mills were closing, the auto plants were closing. I mean,
there was no way this Bozo was going to get reelected.
Yeah, parts of the Midwest have still not recovered from the recession of 1982.
But, you know, he clocked us
right.
in the election.
Right.
So those of us on the progressive side need to remember several things, you mm-hmm. know, to not get disheartened. And the other thing is that the ways in which Obama as president has disappointed me
mm-hmm.
are precisely the ways in which he disappointed me as a candidate.
Okay.
He promised he would up the ante in Afghanistan, and he has.
Mm-hmm.
He promised he would not support single payer, and he'd
right.
go for this hybrid system.
Right.
He has. So in every way that I'm disappointed, it's exactly the way in which I expected to be.
So at least you knew what you were getting. So.
He told us exactly what his policies would be, and for the most part, he's hewn to that line. I think in terms of legitimate criticism is lack of transparency. His administration has disappointed us on some of his promises there, and somehow or another, you know, Guantanamo, he's got to get it shut down.
Yeah, and I think Reagan and Obama both came in, you know, in a time when the country was in, you know, economic disarray, and they were elected in part because, you know, the other party had been blamed for getting us there. And, you know, certainly by the end of Reagan's first term, that had begun to lift. And you know, we can only hope the same will happen for Obama and for all of us.
And let's take another call. Listener in Urbana, line 3, hi.
Hi. I'd like to ask your guest if he has a top 10 suggestions for President Obama to do in the next year to improve things.
Oh, top 10? That would be a pretty long list.
And we don't have much time left.
Well, you know, I would like to, you know, I think he was in some ways rightly criticized for, you know, focusing on, you know, his health care plan at the expense of the economy when he first came into office. And I think that's partly because he knew that this was the big thing he wanted to get done, and he had to get it done right away. So, I mean, I would like to see him focus more on the economy, more on, you know, urban policy, and more on industrial policy in his next 2 years.
And we're going to take another call. Let's see if we can get these last two calls in.
Okay.
Line 1, Urbana, hi.
Hi. I want to say that I think Obama is doing a terrific job. As in the situation he's in, I give him a hooray under the conditions. There's so much I've never seen in my entire life, and I'm nearly 60. I've never seen in my entire life anyone who's had to enter into an election in 2 years. Let me tell you, 2 years, nobody can get nothing done in 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
2 years of such negative lambasting, loud-mouthing, negative propaganda that I've ever seen, and it still hasn't stopped. It's still in the media today against that man. And anything they can get him on, they will do it, and people are just like little sheep. When they listen to this negativity, it affects their decisions. It affects their moral right at looking at somebody as a person instead of someone of color and of an ideology. This man is doing a terrific job, I think, under the conditions he's under. And it's the Senate, it's the constant trying to make someone look bad and not make it in every aspect that he's trying to do. And I think he's doing a terrific job because he's holding his own. He's not getting upset. He's not retaliating. But he's trying to get something done. And he's being stopped in every way possible.
I think it's just easier nowadays for people who dislike the president to express their opinions than it's ever been. I mean, you know, Franklin D. Roosevelt, a lot of people hated him, but there wasn't 24-hour cable TV, and there wasn't the internet. So, negative opinions about, you know, Obama or any other politician are much, much easier to distribute than they used to be.
Let's take another call, our last call this morning. White Heath, line 2, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to make a short comment that earlier you said that Obama is not very humble. Well, I think if we look back at all the presidents that I'm familiar with, and most people are, I think you won't find one humble man.
I think that's true. I think. I remember, you know, him saying on 60 Minutes, like, "Hey, I got myself elected president of the United States." You know, so I don't think that politics attracts humble people, and I don't think success in politics reinforces humility. So I will agree with you on that.
Okay, I want to thank the listener for her call this morning. Well, given that Barack Obama has made Chicago his home base, his hometown, I'm wondering if he hadn't made his run for president and sat it out, do you think he'd have been in this mayor's race?
I think once he went to the Senate, you know, and I think that's one reason people got behind him, you know, to the Senate, because in Illinois, that's where we send all our goody-goody politicians. We send them to Washington. You remember Paul Simon couldn't get elected governor, but he got elected senator. So I think he was kind of put on the Washington track at that point. And I don't know if he would have stepped all the way down from the Senate to run for mayor. Maybe if he'd been a congressman, he might have done it. But I think, that was his original goal when he got into politics. But I guess it's a moot point now because he's got a job and can't quit.
Too late now.
Yes.
One last question. Do you think that Barack Obama would agree that Chicago was the factor that made him president?
I would hope so. I mean, I think he recognized from an early age that this was the place for, you know, an ambitious young African American man to come. I mean, and you know, Jesse Jackson was another politician, another Chicago politician who inspired him when he saw Jesse Jackson up there debating, you know, John Glenn and Gary Hart and Walter Mondale. So I think, even though I don't think he was thinking I'm going to be president someday or I'm going to be mayor someday, I think he knew somewhere inside him that Chicago was the right place for someone with his ambitions.
Mm. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Ted McClelland, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ted McClelland is the author most recently of Young Mr. Obama, Chicago and the Making of a Black President. The book is published by Bloomsbury.